Off the Ball Breakfast.
Was I gone there completely?
No, people are here.
They heard.
Colin forgot his school books and needs to sit with the teacher.
Oh man, that's a great show.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
All right. Only one thing makes Christmas more special than it already is, and that's a man over on the other side of the water, live from Canada. It's the Republic of Ireland's finest, possibly. Kevin Kilbane, how are you?
I'm very good, Cullum. Hardly finest, let's be honest about that. Jesus.
I was just doing an internal survey about it and the results are very positive, Kev. Very positive.
Yeah, when I listen to you every Monday and you kind of research the staff or the guys that you're hosting with that day. So just the name you're researching and coming up with all sorts. So
to see you
researching me is not good.
That is true. No, that was pure unscripted, actually. This is pure unscripted joy for this time of year. I can hear you loud and clear. You're looking fresh. You're looking well. How's 2025 treated you?
I was going to have a shave and I was going to have, I was going to try to wash my hair and brush my hair and everything, but it's not worked out that way this morning, so I'm sorry.
The rugged look suits you, to be fair to you, all day long. You know what I mean? It really does. Come here, it's been quite the year for sport. I was saying there during the week, or a couple of weeks ago at this stage, I was like, when you're picking reading in the year's moments for 2025, the sporting part of it, you're going to have to do a serious edit on those selections.
Absolutely. It's and you know, you get to the end of the year and we would always say at the end of any year, wouldn't we? What an incredible year it's been. We've had this and that. But this year especially has stood alone probably in the last 10 years, I would say, with lots that has happened and so much to talk about, hasn't there? Obviously, myself personally and most of you guys as well that have watched the football team or soccer team over the years we've got excited, haven't we? It's given us reason to believe again, hasn't it? And we've been there so many times where we've had reason to believe, but this year especially, it's probably not this year, in all honesty, because it has 95% of the time has been doom and gloom. But that short window has given us all optimism, hasn't it? In, when was it? October at this stage now.
Mid-November. Like, that was the beauty of it, you know, Kev. It was in the middle of November. Like, there's nothing to write home about at that time of year. Certainly at this part of the year. You know, I know North Americans will celebrate Thanksgiving and all that. I don't know if you've got into that tradition. But here, there's nothing going on.
We have a different Thanksgiving from the US, you know. I think there's a saying up here in Canada that it's Thanksgiving today, but we just prefer to call it Tuesday. That's what they say up here.
So what we've done here, right, what we've decided to do between the two of us is rank your top five sporting moments of 2025. From five to one. And this caused a lot of debate. Like, I mean, we had a couple of phone calls, several voice notes to solidify this list, because so much has happened that there actually are a few honourable mentions as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you and I have been back and forth on this in the last couple of weeks, haven't we? And I don't know if you've mentioned it in there. There'll be a lot of disagreement, I'm sure. I've put one in that we'll talk about in a while I just think it was just almost like a changing of the guards moment, I suppose, as well. But most of them that are in all of them, apart from one, are all Irish related. So I think we all have our green eye on everything that happens around the Irish team, Irish teams or individuals. So that's where I am on this one, yeah.
How did you like Christmas actually as a player?
I never had a Christmas. I always said this, and I probably started on Off the Ball, probably, but not more or less when I finished, maybe a year or two afterwards, but I was certainly doing a lot on Off the Ball, and I've probably been asked this question by you guys when I was in there working with you, and or whether I was just coming on calls and things like that when I initially finished playing. I never had a Christmas. My last Christmas before retiring was essentially when I was 15. I remember even when I was 16 as a YT, we kind of got a couple of weeks off from games and things like that. But I lived very close to Deepdale as a kid. So most of the guys that went home, we had guys from Belfast, Middlesbrough, I'm trying to think, maybe even from the east coast of England that would have been in my youth team, and they all went home. And because I was the local guy, I had to be in at the club every single day. So the first team were training, the first team had games on St. Stephen's Day as well, as you well know. So I was the guy that was having to be, I had a key for the club. I was almost like the caretaker, the janitor. I did everything around the club from 16. So then when you turn pro, it's just games and everything. So Christmas honestly, it was just another day. You couldn't enjoy it. You couldn't enjoy it at all.
What was the first Christmas like in retirement?
That's closer to home now, isn't it? So we can see. I spent it with my dad, actually. Oh. It was nice that we, you know, dad and I actually went to mass.
Yeah.
My dad would have been someone that went to mass an awful lot. So him and I went to mass, and we just chilled out together, and it was nice. I know I was on with you guys a few weeks ago talking. My dad just passed away 10 years now. Yeah. But the last couple of years of his life was so special for us that we had that bit of time around Christmas, around, you know, summer times and things like that. So that was nice that we had that. So, yeah, it was just quiet. I think it was very, very quiet, to be honest with you.
Mm. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
No.
Explain.
Well, it's set at Christmas time, but it's not a Christmas movie. It's not a fun, loving. I always think of Christmas movies, you know, Home Alone, as, you know, pick-me-up movies, real, you know, fun throughout movies. Even going back to when I was a kid watching movies like from Mickey Mouse or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and things like that. So I consider Die Hard an action movie. That's the way I would look at that one, yeah.
But it's set at Christmas Eve in Nakatomi Plaza. And
yeah, but that just gives it more drama, doesn't it, to the action movie itself. It's not a Christmas movie in itself. It's an action movie. You wouldn't say that Bruce Willis is you know, your stereotypical Hugh Grant type lovey-dovey Christmas type character.
Doesn't need to be.
Yeah, I don't associate Die Hard as a Christmas movie, to be honest with you. Great movie, one, from my youth, I would have loved Die Hard, but no, not in my opinion, no.
So you would watch Die Hard in July and have no issue with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I probably did watch it first time in July, or I honestly don't know that, but I would have watched it at some stage out of the Christmas window. Yeah, definitely.
I just think it's Christmas all over, because it's the Christmas party at Nakatomi Plaza on Christmas Eve.
You've got too much knowledge of the movie, Colm,
It's basic stuff. Like, and then when he kills one of the lads, it's a ho, 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 he writes in a T-shirt with a Santa hat.
Yeah. Well, because he's killed someone. So you want killing associated with Christmas and the feeling of goodwill to all men.
Yeah, but it's a light-hearted death.
A light-hearted death.
You know, it's light-hearted. I think there's Christmas music playing when he dies.
Really, really. Yeah. So that enhances your theory, I suppose, then, does it?
No, I thought we'd be aligned here. I really did. I thought you were going to think Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Is Home Alone a Christmas movie?
I'm going to surprise you. Home Alone, absolutely a Christmas movie. Yeah, definitely.
What's the difference?
Well, the reason why, because it's a full Christmas setting around a family at Christmas, isn't it? That's what it is. That's not really about. Die Hard is more about people that want to take over a building and I can't even remember the plot of Die Hard. What is it? I know they're taking over a building, but what's the end game for the criminals in it?
They want their own money, and they want to go off to the island to count their 12.5%, as Hans says, right? But I'll put it to you this way. Home Alone is about two lads taking over a building, a house.
Stealing homes,
Like, you could argue that Nakatomi Plaza, they're a corporate family, and they're together for Christmas.
Jeez, I didn't expect to be going here today, I have to say that. I'll go with you, I'll roll with you on it, but just because it's set on Christmas Eve and there's a Christmas party. Have you ever known a Christmas party that's set on, like, a Christmas party on Christmas Eve?
It's unbelievable.
Have you ever known that?
It's unbelievable, Kev. I was pointing that out a few weeks ago on the show. It just occurred to me.
I didn't hear that, but it's a bit of a strange one having a Christmas party Christmas Eve, isn't it?
It is. It's a classic corporate America. That's how they treat them. Not like in Canada, where they really do treat their employees well, I would imagine.
I saw God Save the King up here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's very true. Listen, do you want to do the top five? Well, we're,
yeah,
while we
on.
Have you.
Let's get cracking.
So, right, we have a few minutes here to do each of these, and it's a very, very competitive list. So we'll start at number five, Kev, for your top five moments of 2025.
Yeah. Well, this is my non-Irish moment. You're going to have to give me a little refresher, but I do know number five.
I will.
Yeah, number five is my non-Irish moment of the year. Yeah. I mentioned before about being a bit of a changing of the guards. I've always been a huge boxing fan. And watching Canelo Alvarez over the years and see him absolute dominate super middleweight and step up to various weights. And he has lost along the way in certain weight divisions when he stepped up in class. But he was almost undefeatable, unstoppable at super middleweight. I didn't think particularly, I would have understood if he would have lost at super middleweight, maybe if he's, you know, mid 40s and he's carrying on and he's past it. I don't think he is at his absolute best, but I didn't feel that there was anyone capable of stopping him at super middleweight. And to see that Terence Crawford box the way that he did against Canelo and have a game plan in place. And I know that Terence Crawford was undefeated. And I'd seen a lot of his fights, Crawford, but I didn't think that he was capable of stopping Alvarez or beating Alvarez. Now, it did go the distance and it went on points, but it was just a domination almost from the first bell. It was an incredible performance, Cullum. Absolutely incredible performance, and a real changing of the guard. And I say that, and I saw recently that Crawford's retired. What a way to end!
I know,
because it was a huge payday, Cullum, wasn't it? Of course, for him. Fine, obviously he didn't get the same amount that Canelo did, and you would think a rematch might be the way to finish his career, but to go out on top like that, what a way to end, if it is the end. Let's be honest, we've heard this from so many boxers in the past, haven't we? But an incredible moment, I think, in the sporting year, Cullum, to be honest with you. Again, watching the fight and seeing so many of Alvarez's fights, as I said, it's not peak Alvarez. It absolutely hasn't been. But for him to step up in certain weight classes, and people can have their argument about, you know, whether they agree or disagree with Alvarez having drugs bans in the past and things like this, and what he's been accused of and things like that. You can't take away at actual super middleweight, he did look unstoppable, Cullum.
Yeah. Because it's, as I say, it's a hell of a competitive year for selection. You could have gone all Irish, so this really means something to you. As you already pointed out, Crawford announced his retirement very recently, and it is very hard to trust boxing retirements, Kev, like you said, that
yes,
you know, you could absolutely come back out, but it's a hell of a way to finish it, because it's on his own terms and it's at the top of his weight class particularly. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I saw something, Cullum, from Tony Bellew recently, and he was saying about, we kind of know how boxing is. It's almost as if you're on that ladder to get to the top. And once you reach the top, it's almost you've got to cash in, make as much money as you can. And I think Bellew was saying this, it's almost make as much money as you can and get out as quickly as you can once you're at the top with as much money as possible. And we kind of know that because of the lasting effect that boxing can have from a health perspective on athletes. So it's interesting that he's finally reached the top. He's finally, you know, at the peak of the mountain. You would think, and I know what, I think Crawford's late 30s, I think at this stage now, but
38, yeah.
He 38, you're thinking two more fights and he's done, maybe certainly finished before he's 40 at this stage.
Yeah.
Given how high his stock is right now, but it was such a surprise to see that, given again, because you would think that the natural thing would be a rematch with Canelo and a potential fight with somebody else just after. But if it is a retirement, what a way to retire it is. Yeah.
It's one of two boxing entries on your list. Where does the love of boxing come from, Kev?
I love boxing as a kid. I loved it. I go back to the era. I was just a little bit young to really appreciate Sugar Ray Leonard, Marvin Hagler, Thomas Hearns and people like this. I was just a little bit too young to fully appreciate it. But I got the Steve Collins, Nigel Benn, Eubank, Mike Tyson phase, Lennox Lewis and people like this, Vander Holyfield. I got that era of boxing when I was, you know, getting to maybe my teenage years.
Yeah.
So I go back to maybe teenage years, Cullum. I loved it. Big nights, Saturday nights. I always remember used to watching boxing. Nigel Benn was always my favourite boxer. He was the guy I loved, just his style that he fought with. And I would always obviously swing towards Irish boxers. So Barry McGuigan, I was just at the end, or just a little bit too young to fully appreciate Barry McGuigan as well, to be honest with you. But I remember Michael Carruth in the Olympics winning gold medal. That was a huge highlight. I remember Wayne McCulloch winning, I think he got a silver at the Olympics as well, Wayne McCulloch. So I loved, it was always something that I look forward to at the Olympics, watching boxing, but definitely the big fights that used to be predominantly in those days on terrestrial TV. So it wasn't behind paywalls or anything.
Did you ever box yourself?
A little bit as a kid, a little bit, but nothing major, no. A little bit of training as a youngster, no, but nothing major. I didn't take it in any way, no.
You were a lover, not a fighter, but you appreciate fighting.
Something like that, yeah.
All right, so November 2025 will definitely go down as one of the great few days in Irish football history. So your number four is Ireland 2, Portugal 0 at the Aviva Stadium in Dublin.
Well, under normal circumstances, that we'd be putting that in at number one, wouldn't we? And we'd be talking about it for, well, we're going to talk about that. But how that result in Dublin can be overshadowed is incredible, really. I was going to put them in as one window, but I think people would know where I'm going to be going elsewhere in this list. But I think that we had to give it individually the respect it's due just for the result. One of the best results we've had at home in our history, and you could probably say, arguably, Cullum, maybe the greatest victory at home ever, given maybe where our team was going into the game, the feeling around the team, given maybe the standard of the players that they're playing at, not real top end. You could make a serious argument for saying it was our greatest ever home performance, best ever result in Dublin. Yeah.
Wow, that good.
Yeah, and I know you're always. It's always when you're looking for quotes, and I would have said things in the past a little bit exaggerated because you get a bit excited in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you do put it into context and you do look at everything around it and what was at stake, given what was happening elsewhere, we simply had to win that game to give ourselves a chance, didn't we? There was no other option, and. I think that even looking back on the game now, when you, because it's hard to really think about that game when you think about that window with what happened only a few days later, but it was such a good performance. The one standout performer, or the two standout performers, I really think of, obviously Troy Parrott. You're going to think of the goals, but aside of Troy Parrott, I just think of Ogbeni and Seamus Coleman. Seamus Coleman to do what he did, coming back and hardly playing at club or international really in the last year.
Yeah.
To do what Seamus did. And then Ogbeni, because he's had so much time out injured as well. He hasn't been right. And it was just great to see those guys in particular. And Ogbeni as well, because Ogbeni was a real out ball for us in the game. Watching the game, we were under a lot of pressure without really... Portugal created an awful lot, I have to say that, in across that first half. But it was exciting to watch. It was an exciting style. I was genuinely on the edge of my seat watching the game, excited watching what was unfolding before me. So to see it go the way that it did, and of course the pantomime effect of Cristiano Ronaldo being sent off, and those incredible images and videos that we've all seen and went round, the viral images of Ronaldo being sent off. It was, and the actions around it was great, wasn't it? It was great.
Yeah, well, like, to back up your shout that might be the best ever performance and result in Dublin for Republic of Ireland. Ireland were 2-0 up before Ronaldo got sent off, so Troy Barrett scored both goals. And then if you look at the Portuguese team that night in Dublin in November, it's pretty frightening on paper. Like, you have himself up front, supported by Bernardo Silva and João Félix. You have Ruben and João Neves in midfield, Vitinha, Diaz at the back, Cancelo. Formidable. And we won 2-0.
Yeah. Well, it's that team, Cullum, will be the next Cullum Bohig in 10-15 years time on Off the Ball will be reading that team out. It might even be yourself. You might still be around. You might not have gone on to greater things elsewhere, Colm, at this stage. But if it is you, you'll be reading that team out and you'll be saying the same things. Look at the team, look at the clubs that they played for, look where these guys were and the standing and the class that they had in coming to Dublin. And alternatively, you'll probably read our guys' names out and you'll see the clubs that our guys were playing at. And I always feel as though sometimes it's a little bit unjust when we do look at the clubs that our guys are playing for, because you know, there's a huge gulf in terms of clubs and people thinking class wise and things like that, but there are ways to get results and bridge that gap when you're playing international football. And I've always felt that it might not necessarily be pretty, it might not necessarily be a great way of playing football, open, solely attractive football, but there are ways to get results, and it's given us a chance now going into to 2026 of qualifying for a World Cup off the back of what happened in Dublin.
Yeah, like, look, Portugal, I guess, weren't as intense as they should have been that night, but like, still, like your claim there about where all the Portuguese were playing their football, and look at the Irish lads, like Finazaz Championship, Jack Taylor Championship, Josh Cullen struggling in the Premier League. That's your midfield three against Portugal.
Yes.
And then Ogbeni up front on loan to another championship club. Just one question, actually. When everyone's fit, right, looking ahead to March in the playoff, no better man to ask this question. What's our strongest left side?
I think you're probably looking at it right now, and even his form across this season, Ryan Manning, essentially, I would feel, is the guy that probably should be playing. I think he's more of the creative player. I think he's learned a more of an overall game as well. It looks as though, Cullen, we'll play the same system, won't we? It'll be a three at the back. It'll be a three, essentially, a 3-5-1-1 system is kind of how we were going about it, or a 3-4-3, however you want to do it. But it becomes almost like a 3-6-1 system, doesn't it, when we don't have possession. So wing back to me, and I think even Manning, when he didn't start in Hungary, came on and he made a difference to us, I think, when Manning came on. So I'd go with Manning. I think Manning probably deserves to be starting in that game if he's fully fit, yeah.
Okay. That's a hell of a thing to look forward to, isn't it, in March? 2026. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
He's given us something special, hasn't it? Totally. Look forward to this year, or next year,
Totally. Now we'll probably be back to Ireland shortly on this list, but in the meantime, number three on Kevin Kilbane's list of top five sporting moments in 2025, it's Rory McIlroy at the Masters to complete the Grand Slam. Kev, he's four ahead on the 12th on Sunday.
Yeah,
but it eventually goes to a playoff with Justin Rose. Everyone is losing their minds at this point.
I'm glad you just refreshed me on that point there. It was typical Rory, wasn't it? Watching Rory, like we've all supported him over the years and really enjoyed watching him when he's blown people away in tournaments and gone on and won by 6 or 8 shots or whatever it's gone to be. But he's had these moments, hasn't he? And it makes him even more watchable, doesn't it? I mean, there might be many would argue, I'm sure of that it's probably the greatest sporting event this year, in terms of what he achieved and, you know, and achieving that Grand Slam, because we've all been waiting for it for such a long time. The positions that he's been in at the Masters so often, in a position to go on and strike and win it. And it felt as though, as you said, having that lead at 12, I would probably think in my head, having the lead after 9 holes is what I was thinking in my head. I didn't realise it was actually that close when you're thinking back that far now.
Yeah, it was the 13th in the water.
So close to the end of the round. But it felt that way, didn't it, Cullen, watching it, that it was, oh, here we go again. Oh, God. But look, that sport, I suppose we could always say, you look at it philosophically now, and I'm a lot older, that doesn't even play any sport now. But when you look at it, and I think the more remarkable thing about that round is not how, you know, how it went for him across the course of that round, was how he was able to pick himself up in round and do what he did in that playoff to get himself, of course, to you know, to finish off, obviously tied up at the end of the 72 holes, and then to continue just to refocus and do what he did, because it was an unbelievable playoff haul that he had, hasn't it, to win the Masters in the end. It was unbelievable, really. And yeah. Justin Rose, for everything that he'd done, he looked as though that he'd just been steady enough, continued to do what he'd done throughout, and maybe out of his career, Justin Rose, steady away, very Nick Faldo-like. But Rory, you know, he's just, you can't help but watch him when he's playing, because you know that special things can actually happen.
Everybody was collectively wrecked in this country on the Monday morning after that, because yeah. like the Sunday starts, so it looks like it's going to be Rory versus Bryson, and there's an existing rivalry yes. anyway, and then Bryson falls away very early, and he's on the 13th, Rory, everything's going so swimmingly for him, he's four ahead, and then the ball does start swimming, it's in the water, and I'm standing up at this point about to go to bed, it's approaching the wee hours of Sunday night in Ireland, because we have to be up for the show.
Do you know what he hit? I can't remember, what did he hit on 13, Colin? Do you remember that off the top of your head now? What did he shoot?
What did he finish on the hole, or no, what did he use?
No. What did he finish on the hole?
Oh, double bogey.
Did he take
double bogey?
Double bogey was yeah. it? Was it double right? So yeah. then you kind of had that feeling though, didn't you? After that hole, it was. I was in my head. I was thinking a triple. That's why I was asking you that. So I just wanted clarification. So thanks for that.
Yeah,
but
double bogey.
Yeah. What I'm thinking, it felt as though that. Oh no! I'm sure everyone felt that way, and it did go like that for the next few holes, didn't it? For him, it was just, oh, it's happening again. It was remarkable. It was, wasn't it? Let's be honest. Now you think about it in sporting terms, and how very different golf is from most other sports. We've all played, haven't we? And we've all got, you know, stressed out with stuff in a ball, and next shot you stand up and you hit the ball so sweetly, and it's the most frustrating game out there. And you can only imagine what it's like for those guys at elite level and how frustrating it is for them, can't you?
But there's like several narratives within these last few holes for Rory alone, because he actually has the perfect layup on the 13th to save himself. So he doesn't score too badly. Meanwhile, Rose ties the lead on the 16th. But the next hole, Rory drops a shot as well on the 14th. And it's actually the 15th, yes. which is probably the shot of his life. That sets up eagle. And he misses yes. the eagle, but he gets the birdie. And then he's a couple of more approaches. And on the 18th, then he goes into the bunker. So he's yes. constantly saving himself with his like majestic play. But he's also getting yes. himself in trouble. It's the perfect encapsulation of Rory McIlroy.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That would you say the hole 13 to 18, that last five or six holes or whatever it was so I wasn't doing it, but you can almost imagine people at home with a cushion in front of the face kind of peeking around it, watching it, cringe stuff, you know, that you wanted to watch it, but you just didn't want to see the disaster that you felt was about to unfold in front of you. And then he kept on producing moments of magic, as you said. It was an unbelievable, I don't know probably how long, what would have been an hour of golf or whatever it would have been. It was an unbelievable hour of golf watching that. And as you say, I can only imagine how everybody felt after it. You wouldn't have even wanted to go and have a drink after that, would you? It wasn't even like, it was just, oh, you just felt, you just so flat after it, I suppose. You could hardly really have sheer elation off the back of it, watching it, because it was just so, as you say, like maybe mentally numbing when you were watching, or a bit of a mental killer for you watching that at the end.
How could you end up being so happy for this multi-millionaire, like, who has an unrelatable lifestyle, but you, when he sinks the putt to win the Masters and become only the sixth player to win a Grand Slam and the first European, you cheered for him like he had never won a thing in his life. Like he was the biggest underdog ever to play the sport.
That's a fair analogy. It did feel like it was the underdog winning a tournament, didn't you? we're always the underdogs as Irish forever, as far as our lifetime has been. So that it did feel a little bit like that. We were cheering on the underdog, not one of the greatest players ever. It didn't feel that way. It didn't feel that Rory was in that category at that stage, did he?
Not at all. Well, listen, the list is flying along here, because speaking of underdogs,
I think we need to mention, just so you mentioned honourable mentions, if we're talking golf, we didn't mention Ryder Cup.
Sorry, yes.
That was another one that could have gone in there, Cullum, as well, wouldn't
Bang
it?
On.
So
yeah.
that was amazing.
That Sunday at the Ryder Cup, Jesus Christ.
Okay. I actually think Thursday was more exciting, to be honest with you. Or not exciting, that was probably the most spoke about event that, or spoke about day of that Ryder Cup, with what happened to Rory when he was getting absolutely abused on that first day of the Ryder Cup, and that just kind of took it through for the rest of the the competition.
Oh, yeah, there's loads in it. Like, so the Friday morning, the start is like Bryson does the Happy Gilmore drive, and then Rory does his own one
Friday.
And the like, the atmosphere is visceral. And then Keegan Bradley, like, what's going to happen with him as captain? Is he going to play or not? And then, like, the US just messed it up on their own patch, like, because it was, the course is on their terms. Then they have like a terrible partnership, the 132nd out of 132 availabilities. The partnering's all over the place. The wrong players teeing off. Europe have a historical advantage heading into the last day in singles, and yet America nearly win it on Sunday.
Yeah.
It's so much drama to have the heart rate go all over the shop.
Yeah, and that doesn't even make the top five.
Doesn't even make the top five. It's just an honorable mention.
I know there'll be many that won't agree with my selection off the back of that, but it was and to be honest with you, on the Saturday I was in and out. I wasn't able to watch. I'm not too sure if I was actually working or something that day. I don't know what I was, but I was in and out on the Saturday. So it looked after the Saturday that it was done, wasn't it? That was it. There was no comeback. And then initially I was in and out on the Sunday, and then when you were seeing the results starting to come in and you were seeing that the US have got a chance of doing this, then you were then engrossed back in it again. So it was phenomenal. It was really,
like Europe's putting on day one just blew America away. Then America played much better on the second day, on the Saturday, but Europe's putting was better again. And I suppose the Saturday for us is dominated by the abuse that Rory McIlroy and Erica McIlroy were receiving around the course, and Shane Lowry being half bouncer, half golfer. And then, you know, everyone then is roused to it. And then Saturday night is a demolition job, Irish time.
Yeah.
You wake up on Sunday and it's just a procession, Kev. It's meant to be, this is about to be a lap of honour. And it ended up being like an episode of Take Me Out with all the red, going down.
It has to be that way. I think, doesn't it?
And that's just an honourable mention. That doesn't even make top five. So number three officially was Rory McIlroy completing the Grand Slam by winning the Masters. And you mentioned the underdog on Irish Sports People, which is the segue, I suppose, into number two on the list, because Katie Taylor speaks like an underdog with her humility.
Yeah.
But she is far from it, because she is a bona fide star and legend of the sport. So this is Katie Taylor versus Amanda Serrano from this year, part three.
Yeah. Look, again, many could argue this can go in at number one. There's so many that we could put at number one. And probably under normal circumstances, I would have put this at number one, because this was almost... can you say to complete her greatness? That's maybe not the right term to use. It doesn't even sound right me saying that, but it was almost just to emphasize her greatness, I suppose, around the trilogy that she had with Serrano. I've watched so much of Katie Taylor's career. Who was the girl she lost against? Cameron, wasn't it? When she lost to Cameron.
Chantal Cameron, yeah.
Yes, and then to have this trilogy. I obviously watched all three fights, and the narrative around all three fights was, and I don't know anyone, I'm sure that a lot of people that watched the fight would have watched it on Netflix. So I felt so disrespectful to Katie Taylor. Around the whole narrative was Serrano and what Serrano is going to achieve. And if you look at it, even from the first two fights, the first fight, they were almost dismissing Katie Taylor that she didn't win the fight. And it was quite even, the first fight. I think legitimately you could say it was touch and go, but she got the nod. And you couldn't, when she did get the nod, you could seriously say people could make the total argument that she won the fight. And as much as I could see the other side, maybe a draw could have been a fair result off the back of that first one. I don't know. But absolutely, she won the fight. She got it. She was probably the more aggressive in the fight. Then obviously the second one with the head clash.
Yeah.
That ended the fight. And then, you know, the dismissiveness and the disrespect that Serrano's corner had for Katie Taylor, that, you know, Katie Taylor's fighting style, you know the way that she's a very front foot fighter, a very aggressive, very forward fighter. Everybody kind of knows how Katie Taylor fights, and it was a heads clash. There was nothing, you know, it absolutely wasn't meant watching it. But anyway, that ended up being a key factor in that fight. And going into the third fight, it was almost dismissing what Katie Taylor had done. Katie Taylor had won the first two fights. She was... the second one, obviously, with the head clash, but she'd won the fight easily. Yeah. I felt in the second one, and going into that third fight, there was very little talk of Katie Taylor and her greatness. And I always feel as though when you're watching broadcasts, and you've got to obviously try to be as balanced as possible, but recognize what Katie Taylor had done for boxing, recognize what Katie Taylor had done for, obviously in our country, what she'd done for young women, and really brought the sport on. But just the sport worldwide, globally, women's boxing would not be as popular as it is now without Katie Taylor, with what she did to get boxing into the Olympics, with what she did to bring women's boxing into the to the forefront of people's mind, but also to back it up with, we won't see many better boxers, male or female, dominate. And or Irish, well, I'd say globally, to be honest with you, globally, there won't be many boxers that will dominate like Katie Taylor has done. But she's ours, and that is where we cherish her that much, because she's easily the greatest female athlete of all time. Right up there, if not our greatest athlete of all time, Katie Taylor, with what she's achieved, how humble she is, how dominant she's been, and where she has actually fought and where she's gone to fight. And she's never ducked anything. She's gone into arenas that have been anti Katie Taylor and pro whoever she's going to fight, and she's taken it on the chin and gone and beat them. And I've just loved watching her. I love watching her at the Olympics in 2012 when she won gold, but off the back of that, seeing her once she turned pro do what she's done, I'm in total admiration of her in every single way.
Listen, Katie Taylor is a topic well covered, but you still managed to describe that beautifully about what she means to Irish people. Because I suppose you could say about Katie Taylor, if she wasn't Irish, you'd still really respect and enjoy what she's done for boxing. And we're just so privileged that she happens to be from up the road. The one thing about Katie Taylor is that humility again, is that she doesn't really do smack talk in a sport that's dominated by it. But she did defend herself at times this year in the back and forth with Amanda Serrano in the press conferences that, she was looking at my record against you. And I do wonder, in your love of boxing, Kev, does that include the pageantry of the words exchanged beforehand?
You kind of know at times. You kind of know. When you're watching it sometimes, you know that sometimes it's trying to hype it up and trying to be a little bit stage managed. And you know genuinely when there's hatred. You kind of can get on board a little bit when there's real dislike for each other, when they don't like each other's personalities. That has been the remarkable thing about Katie Taylor, you say, with all the smack talk. I think in the third Serrano fight, I think she kind of shut them up a little bit, say, look, I am 2-0 against Serrano.
That's right.
And look, we'll see. I don't think she ever overly said, look, I am, I'm going to go and do what I did in the first two fights. I think it was more of, look, I'm 2-0 against you. We'll just see how this next one goes.
Yeah.
Quietly confident, being respectful to your opponent, which I've come from maybe a background in that in my sport, which you would have been, tried to be respectful, but also having that self-belief and the belief in your teammates that you can go and do something. That in boxing is when you're putting up those sort of words that we've been said about Katie, I think it would have driven her. And I think it's her personality obviously will never be the smack talk coming out and things like this and shit talking to them all. But I just like the quiet confidence and self-belief that she's always carried. And she carries it in a way that, as you say, if she wasn't Irish, we'd still be talking about her. We wouldn't obviously be talking about her in overly glowing terms. We'd still be talking about and respecting her for what she did. We'd still be chatting around her. But because she's Irish, because she's done so much for our country and for women's sport in general, I think we are so proud of her, and we're so proud of her achievements and everything. And, whether or not she comes back and fights again, we've all been hopeful that she was able to get that Croke Park gig, and hopefully that can happen in 2026. But if it doesn't happen, we can still marvel at her achievements and see what she's done on the world stage. Yeah.
Spot on, Kev. So before we get to number one, let's do a recap here. So number five on Kevin Kilbane's top five sporting moments of 2025, it's Terence Crawford defeating Canelo Alvarez at super middleweight. And then Terence Crawford, of course, retired in mid-December. Number four, Ireland versus Portugal. Two goals by Troy Parrott, one of the greatest nights in Irish football history. Maybe the best ever, according to Kev, in Dublin. Number three, Rory McIlroy completing the Grand Slam, winning the Masters earlier this year. Number two, Katie Taylor beating Amanda Serrano again this year. And in all of the stuff that happened this year, Kev, in the last 12 months, it's been stacked with incident across all sports. We haven't even mentioned GAA, rugby, and other things like athletics as well.
Because I mean, seeing David Clifford in the All-Ireland final was great to
outrageous.
See. Outrageous. That footage, I think I've mentioned it to you guys as well, that footage that went around on social media, the two-pointer that he got just before halftime, or right on the buzzer, actually, wasn't it?
That's right.
Was, you know, you could see that on any montage going around the world, couldn't you? In any sport. It was phenomenal, and it shows true greatness of what he did in that moment, didn't he? Amazing to watch and see what he's done. And I remember I was actually at the minor All-Ireland final. Jesus, what we're going back now. Probably 10 years at this stage. He was 17, and we heard about this kid. I think he scored two or three goals in an All-Ireland minor final for Kerry years ago. And we'd all heard the name about this guy's going to be a phenomenon. And you know, how difficult is it for anyone when they've got that expectation on the shoulder? He's gone on to a different level, David Clifford. What a player he is.
Stop. And also, your honourable mention, the Ryder Cup, of course, that we put with the Masters. And then there's other things as well, like Kate O'Connor and athletics. That was an amazing summer as well. Katie McCabe in the Champions League with Arsenal was huge.
Correct.
But Kev, there is only room for the official top spot. Take us away.
Emotionally, I think, you know, I've spoken about anyone that would have watched Rory McIlroy, Katie Taylor over the years can really get on board with what they have achieved with the emotional aspect of it and things like that. And seeing, you know, someone like Rory McIlroy burst into tears after sinking the putt to win the Masters. But me growing up and every Irish supporter growing up, we've not had massive moments that come around too often. And we've spoken so much about that Portugal game. I don't think we really fully expected it. We'd certainly gone into the window. We didn't expect to get 6 points. We were never in that position to do that. But I think the Portugal result gave us all a little bit more belief. We didn't really expect it to happen. I think that's what it would be. If we came away and we played well and, sure, lads, we had a decent window. But I don't think emotionally watching an Irish game I've ever felt the way that I felt in that Hungary game. It was just, and certainly as an adult anyway, certainly since I've finished playing, I think that'll be the case. It was I don't know. I don't know what words you can use to describe it, Cullen, that moment when Troy Parrott scored in the 96th minute or whatever it was. I don't think you can use a word to describe it because there are no words. It was outrageous. It was phenomenal. It was incredible. Whatever word that you choose to use, it's insufficient. It was remarkable. Absolutely remarkable what happened.
Yeah, like too right. You know, it was all protocol and professionalism went out the window on that Sunday night for us preparing for that Monday morning show. You know, it was just like, we're just going to be talking about how this made us feel. And then there was montages galore, and it was just playing video and watching people celebrate in Ireland and all around the world, in Hungary as well. And it was just just one long, elongated description of what this actually meant to everyone. Yeah. But
I said it when I was on to Owen, sorry, Cullen, when I was talking to him as well. I was chatting to him around it. And look, I'm a broadcaster to an extent, but you're a broadcaster, and we know how we're watching things and we're trying to put things into context when we watch them. But I felt, and I again not want to be too critical of anyone individually, but I felt that RTE got it wrong when they came back to studio and how they were analysing that certainly the window, that performance against Hungary, really talking too much about the tactical side of it and what happened across the game and all these sort of things, which, you want to know. I didn't feel as though, look, I think we've seen stuff that went out afterwards. I saw Kevin Doyle sprinting around the studio and you know, his reaction. That should have been maybe the first thing that was shown as soon as he went back in. I don't know. And again, I don't be too critical because it's hard. I understand it, and I've worked in TV and I've done a lot of games, and you come back and you try to get it right. But I just felt as though that given the magnitude of that result, I just felt that the post-match analysis wasn't right for how big a result that was. And the tone didn't seem right to me. It didn't sit right with me when I was watching it. And then you cut to Troy Parrott and Antonio Dunne. Because you know what? Darren Maloney and Ray Houghton were so good. That the call was so good at the end. It was great to listen to that. And we've all heard it 1,000 times. And you know, the words that Dara used, how, you know, whatever anyone thinks of commentary teams, everyone's going to have the likes and preferences and dislikes or whatever. But it was great. It was great to listen to. And then you got Tony Donoghue pitch side with Troy Parrott and seeing the tears and what it meant to him. I was crying watching Troy Parrott. I really was. It was. I don't think anyone watching it couldn't have got really involved and become emotional listening to him. And I just felt as though I felt that personally. I felt that in the aftermath of that. I just felt as though that in context of everything again across our history, that was as big a win, if not the biggest win that we've ever had. Given again, as I spoke about earlier on. I know it didn't qualify for us for anything, but look where the team were. Look what's happened in the last few years. Look at, you know, the mess that's been created around our game, and we're trying to build ourselves up. That was almost like a defining moment for me and a bit of a wake up call for everyone watching about where our game is and how highly thought of our team is. It's the biggest thing in Ireland. It's the biggest thing in Irish sport, without a doubt it is.
I remember doing the permutations earlier that week before the Portugal game, and because it was quite subtle and complex to do with the other teams about what Ireland actually needed to do and needed to get out of the doubleheader against Portugal and Hungary. And it was, you know, well, if we draw here and lose there, but if they do us a favour, we might get through, we'll get a point here, 3 points there. And then the final permutation was just, if Ireland win both games, they get a playoff. And everyone just laughed. Do you know, it was like that was a joke to think that they would win both games. A complete joke. You wouldn't be taken seriously.
I think that's exactly it. And you know what had happened through the group. It's pointless even analysing the group, analysing what happened in Armenia, analysing what happened against Hungary at home when Hungary should have been out of sight by half time in that game as well. Analyze, look back at the individual performance of Quivín Kelleher throughout, incredible, statistically the best through qualification of any goalkeeper. Look what happened with Troy Parrott at the end of that window. The only thing we really look back on now, and it's such a sad thing to say. That's why I had to maybe give that Portugal win a little mention within it, because it will always be overlooked. Portugal, how can you say that? Beating Portugal at home, which if you look at it in context, is probably against the calibre of players that Portugal have, it probably is our best ever performance, given again where our guys are. It's overlooked because of what happened there in Hungary. And that last 10 minutes, Troy Parrott's equaliser in the 81st minute or whatever it was in the game, the last 10 minutes, I don't think anyone could take their eyes off it.
Yeah.
And the feeling, the sickness in the pit of your stomach, you know, seeing chance out, or, you know, not chance after chance, I suppose, but, you know, opening, I suppose you would say, getting into the penalty area and nothing coming of it. And then your stomach's going and Quivín Kelleher's making a couple of saves up the other end.
Yeah, yeah.
Hungary's getting chances late on. It was unbelievable watch that last 10 minutes. If you could just put, you know, bottle 10 minutes of sport into and give it everybody and just watch this last 10 minutes. That was the most incredible last 10 minutes of a game. And then for it to end the way that it did, I can't even use words. I can just waffle on a lot of crap.
It's perfect.
It doesn't do it justice, Colm. Doesn't do it justice.
No, it does. It does. You're bringing me back there with the way you've described it, because that last 10 minutes alone, like the Johnny Kenny opportunity, which is saved.
Yeah. And, you know, when you think, we'd have been talking about that, wouldn't we? We probably wouldn't have been critical or anything about the miss. We wouldn't have been after, because we were so happy. If we'd have drawn the game 2-2, and we'd have come off and we'd have gone, look, what if Kenny would have scored that goal? And we'd have been, I know, but what a performance. It gives us a bit of hope for the future. That's the way we would have been. And being an Irish fan and watching the team over the years, that's genuinely how it kind of ends for us. That's what happens. And look, I just think with what unfolded, you couldn't have scripted it.
Yeah.
And for us, again, that's watched so much heartache, so many bad days and so many performances that have been good performances, and we look on, it'll maybe gives us hope for the future, and it doesn't quite happen. I don't think the playoff to me is, look, if we get there, great. I really think it is a wake-up call for us all about how we've got to really view our team and what's needed to take the team forward, because it's so important to Irish sport that our Irish football team is performing and doing well and competing and competitive, should I say.
Quevin Kelleher talked about the Hungary game a few weeks after, and he reminded me as well, he was like, they actually had a chance right at the end after Troy Parrott's winner, when Dominic Szoboszlai took a touch, his former teammate, and he thought Szoboszlai's going to shoot here. And he said, if he took a shot, there's a good chance it would have gone in, because I was so nervous. But instead, remember, he changed his mind last second, or he dinked it.
Cullen, did they have like, I think they had like a 4-on-2 at one stage. It was, or a 3-on-2
they
or something.
They had a chance to claim it, yeah.
They had an overload, didn't they? Yeah. It was almost as if they were being a little bit elaborate with the ball. They weren't, it was just these moments like that. And that could have been the one, actually, where I think there was a shot that could have got off, and it probably was Szoboszlai. I can't remember.
He crossed, he dummied and crossed it in, and then Kelleher claimed it, and kind of that was it then. But I, like, we could talk about it all day, but like what I love hearing is people's story of where they were when Parrott scores the winner. Where were you?
I was banished to the bedroom, Cullen. The kids were downstairs, so I had it on the telly at the start of the game, and the kids were going crazy in the house, and I thought, look, I just said, look, I need peace to watch this. I just need I need an hour or two to watch this game. And the kids were going crazy. I don't even know what they wanted on. The weather was starting to turn here and everything as well. The snow hadn't started at that stage, but it was starting to turn. And it's almost one of them, you want, go on, get out the door and go and play outside for a little bit, or whatever it would be that you can't really do nowadays, I suppose. So I think that they ended up winning the battle, and they had Bluey on, or whatever it was that they would have had on. I don't know what it was, to be honest with you. And I ended up just coming, I come upstairs, and my wife's downstairs, and she said that she's hearing me on the floor, jumping up and down on the floor with every, you know, chance or opening that we were having, or a chance that Hungary was having. So I was in the bedroom. I kind of watched it on my own in the bedroom, with one of my daughters running up and down the stairs every 5 minutes after I was jumping up. I remember even the penalty from Troy Parrott. When Troy Parrott got the penalty, I was up like screaming that we'd equalised the game, and it was almost, have you won? Is the game over? No, we've equalised. My wife doesn't have a clue about football, and she doesn't want to have a clue about the game, but she's like looking at me going, all right, okay, I'll speak to you in 10 minutes or so. No, not realising the significance of it, you know.
That was amazing. So if the Portugal game was the greatest match for Ireland in Irish soil, what is the Hungary match?
Oh, I think the best feeling, one of the greatest feelings, I know I can over exaggerate it a little bit. You can't take away the feeling of seeing Ray Houghton score against England in 88. Yeah. You can't take away the feeling of Kevin Sheedy scoring against England for the first World Cup goal in 90, and Niall Quinn scoring against Holland in 90, and Ray Houghton against Italy in 94. You can't take away those feelings. You really can't. And the big moments that we had. But I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too sentimental now and nostalgic. But certainly as an adult watching the team, that's the best I've ever felt watching Ireland, yeah.
Yeah. Terence Crawford dethroning Canelo Alvarez at super middleweight. Ireland beating Portugal. Rory McIlroy winning the Masters and completing the Grand Slam. Katie Taylor beating Amanda Strano again. And the Republic of Ireland's heroics in Hungary. Some list, Kev, from 5-1 to summarize.
I tried to do it justice. There'll be a lot of people that disagree with me, and I'm sure of that. But look, that's where I am. Katie, there's many that would say Katie Taylor should be number one. Many would say Rory should be number one. But I don't think anyone, probably I'd say 90% of Irish sporting fans would probably cherish that Troy Parrott moment the most, yeah.
Well, I'll leave you with this. The majority of people have agreed with you that Die Hard is not a Christmas film. According to Sky News, they've done a survey on it. They've asked the people. They've come back. The people have said that 44%... believe it is not a Christmas Jesus movie. 38% say it is. Bruce Willis himself was asked in 2018, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Bruce Willis simply said, it's a goddamn Bruce Willis movie. This was a Kevin Caban interview, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Kev, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to everybody. Thanks, Cullum. Thank you so much.